Well, hello everyone. You're probably wondering what this video is even doing in your feed. What academic agent recommending left-wing books? Well, there's a little bit of backstory to this one, because it seems that that cavalcading car crash of cringe himself, James Lindsay, did not take kindly to a recent video of mine where I pointed out the reasons that his woke right nonsense hasn't really taken, and well, he decided to start going after me as well as various other friends of mine on Twitter. Now I'll tell you more about that in a second, but how can I put this? The experience of coming up against Lindsay himself and some of his followers, and he does have some apparently, has brought me face to face with some of the most virulent anti-intellectualism I've seen in quite some time, not to mention some of the stupidest stuff. I mean, honestly, it reminds me a little bit of when I was debating communists 8 years ago. You know, the standard of argumentation, the stupid things these people are saying. And, well, basically, the reason I'm making this video is that there is value in reading left-wing books sometimes. Left-wing people and leftists can be right on some things. And in this video, I'm going to recommend 10 books which I think are illuminating and shed some light on politics, culture, political tactics and strategy, and many other topics. The left, okay, we're on the opposite side to them. We disagree with the utopia that they're aiming for. We disagree with some element of equality. And more or less, we disagree with the left on almost everything, on a moral, metaphysical level. That does not mean, however, that there are not things that we can learn from them. And, well, let's get a move on. So basically what triggered this was a comment by me. I was just replying to some dude on Twitter saying, he asked me, you know, what would be on your Mount Rushmore of left-wing powerhouse thinkers? I made some comment about Antonio Gramsci being worth reading. And I said, well, some of the Frankfurt School, Gramsci, Althusser, Foucault, they all got some things fundamentally correct against job or opposition, the center-right, which is why they won. But also they were playing on easy mode, okay? And then Carl Benjamin, of the Lotus Eaters fame, came in and replied to that and said, Marcuse, Adorno, Horkheimer are all people I have read and been impressed by, to be honest. Note the 101 replies to that comment. Now, I'm not going to go through those replies, but it was some of the most brain-dead stuff I've ever seen. People outright calling Carl a communist, a leftist, woke, and all the rest of it, because he said that he was impressed by some of the Frankfurt School. Because, you know, they're the Frankfurt School and they're evil leftists. So you can't, you know, if you touch them, you're immediately going to become a communist. You know, this is really stupid. And it's pretty dispiriting, actually, to see stuff like this. Then this chap, Wokal Distance, who I'm told has quite a big following, found this comment of mine and came in on top of it. He said Foucault was wrong about nearly everything he wrote. The criticisms of the Frankfurt School and the postmodernists are not good. For example, the critique of instrumental rationality is totally failed. Why are we dumpster diving for old leftist ideas to try to fix things? Now, I don't want to go into all the back and forth, but, you know, okay, Michel Foucault may have had problematic views on, you know, having sex with youngsters, and he may have been a degenerate, and he may have had all sorts of terrible ideas, and he may have been wrong about all sorts of other things. But he did get some things right. He is actually quite a compelling thinker on power, discourse, knowledge, how those things intersect, on how institutions have been used by power and abused by power. Really interesting books. That's why he's one of the most, if not the most cited thinker of the past 30, 40, 50 years. And it's just kind of, it's like, well, you don't have to totally dismiss someone just because they're on the other side. I also tweeted out this. I said, be a conservative, get your ass kicked by the left for 70 straight years as you surrender every institution to them, and then reflexively mock, insult, and laugh at anyone who suggests the key theorists of leftist institutional takeover might have got some things right. You know, because this is essentially what we're seeing here. Anyway, it continued. This guy, classical liberal, said, oh, look, here are some of the things that key theorists of communism have got them right. And then he just talks about, you know, all of the bad stuff about communism. And I just said, look, it's possible to be right about some things and wrong about others. Can you stretch to that level of complexity? Now, here's what the left is good at. They're good at getting their own way, aka politics and power. They're good at bullying conservatives into submission. And tomorrow, I'll have a video especially on why conservatives are stone cold losers. That should be an interesting one, too. Third, they're good at subverting and taking over institutions and culture. Fourth, they're good at organization and being committed to the cause. And fifth, they're good at strategy and tactics. What they're not good at is things like basic food production, thinking about incentives, or to use the old Thomas Sowell catchphrase, thinking beyond stage one. They're not good at making social orders that last or that anybody really wants to be a part of. They're really not very good at all at understanding the right or right-wing thought in general. Major blind spot for the left. Jonathan Haidt more or less explains why. And finally, they're pretty bad at knowing how and when to back off. In fact, one of the things that Lenin says in his writings, I'll be talking about Lenin in a moment, is, you know, when you find steel, back off. When you find mush, plunge the bayonet. Okay. So Lenin was saying there's a time to back off and a time to lean in and plunge the bayonet. I often think that the left don't know when to quit, when they're ahead, or when they're actually up against some strength. That's interesting to watch play out. Anyway, unfortunately, there is more of this James Lindsay nonsense. He quoted this out. He said, woke right actually explains how it's woke right, in the words of one of their British Iranian thought leaders, Nima Parvini, aka Academic Agent, who is the real brains behind the Lotus Eaters, a show I've only appeared on three times, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. Hard to deny it when they say it themselves, featuring an explanation by Bruce Pardee. No, the explanation by Bruce Pardee basically recreates the political triangle that I made about 6 years ago. If you have a look in my back catalogue, there's a video called The Infinite Horseshoe that explains why the three sides, that is liberals, conservatives, and leftists, viewed from the other two sides, cannot distinguish between, any one side. So a leftist cannot actually tell the difference between a liberal and a conservative. And so it is true from the liberal perspective, both the other two sides seem like the same, right? And so it is from the harder conservative perspective as well. Everybody looks to them like a leftist, okay? So that's why it's called infinite horseshoe theory. So I don't know why everybody's praising this Bruce Pardee video, because it's really pretty obvious. And like I said, I pointed out myself many years ago. You can have a look for the video. It's called The Infinite Horseshoe, or The Infinite Horseshoe Triangle, or something like that. Anyway, I just said James Lindsay is an extremely silly person. His definition of woke right seems to extend from everybody to Candace Owens to, and what this is a clip of, is me talking about the Frankfurt School theorist and psychologist, Eric Fromm, who I'll talk more about. He's going to be one of the 10 books, saying that there's a need for community, that, you know, in a mass capitalist culture, sometimes people feel like they're unmoored and like they have a need for community. And Eric Fromm talks about how the medieval peasant may have had that in his little village, okay? And that is a human need. But from the point of view of James Lindsay, this proves the horseshoe that, ooh, look, this guy who's nominally right-wing agrees with this guy who's nominally left-wing, therefore communism equals fascism or something. This is not a serious person. This is a really stupid person saying a really stupid thing. Eric Fromm, okay, he was on the polar opposite end to most people watching this. He was a Frankfurt School theorist, you know, borderline communist, left-wing thinker, etc., etc., etc. But he had some genuine insights into human nature and into why people have their political preferences, okay? This is like a serious thing. It goes beyond left or right. He's just talking about human beings, life in general, and how these kind of primal needs shape what people want out of their governments, out of their societies, out of their culture. But to James Lindsay, this just means, oh, look, you know, woke, it's woke. Eric Fromm, Frankfurt School, woke. He's talking about this, therefore he's woke. I mean, this is just stupid. And really, we need to be better than this in 2024. James Lindsay needs to be better than this. Here's another one of Lindsay's followers. I think he quoted this as well. They really are naming Nima Parvini really unlocked the connection to the woke ideology of the right TM and the left TM. This video mentions Asabiya and Middle Ages Arab philosopher Ibn Khaldun. Yeah, the woke 12th century historian Ibn Khaldun. I mean, what is this? So this guy made a thread, and it turns out that some Marxist at some point mentioned Ibn Khaldun, okay? And he's got like, I mean, it's almost like watching a schizophrenic thing, okay? They've got like the name highlighted in the text, and it's like, ooh, look, he mentioned Ibn Khaldun. This dude mentioned Ibn Khaldun. He was woke. You must be woke. This is stupid. And this is basically the methodology that these people are using. At the moment, I had an encounter with another guy who, you know, looked into the stuff I've written, and he noted that in my book, Prophets of Doom, I mentioned Vico, you know, Giambattista Vico, very interesting counter Enlightenment thinker. And he used the same method. Oh, this Marxist at this point mentioned Vico, and he was woke, therefore you must be woke because you mentioned Vico. And it's like, this is just, I mean, it's just so crazy, you know? An Italian dude writing in 1725 was woke, or Ibn Khaldun was woke now. James Lindsay and his followers are a special type of moronic. It's like they believe that if you touch a book by Antonio Gramsci, you immediately become a communist. Do not pass go. Do not collect £200. Thus, it is revealed that the real meaning of woke right is reading books that are not on a list approved by James Lindsay. If it's not already obvious, leftists can be right about some things. I'll break it down in a logical format, since James likes logic, apparently. You can pick up a course here at the Academic Agency, Foundations of Logic, one part of the Trivium. Thousands of people have done that course. I suggest you, James Lindsay, pick it up. You might learn something. Here is all of the things that are right in the world. Here are things leftists believe, right? There is an overlap. Okay, do you see that bit where it crosses over? On the left, we have a very smart maths man whose mind is blown here by basic logic. Seems like for James, because leftists are quote unquote woke, they're almost like lepers. Anything they touch becomes tainted and becomes woke, right? Because they're wrong about some things, they must be wrong about all things. I mean, this is the mind of an idiot here. Anyway, I've rambled enough. That was a 15-minute intro. Let's get into these 10 books that I'm going to recommend, because they could actually challenge the way you think about politics too.
Academic Agency.
Number one, Vladimir Lenin, Left-Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder. James Lindsay, yet again, mind blown. Oh my God, Lenin, he was a communist and he's writing a book having a go at people who are left-wing. Oh my God, how can this be? And look, this guy, academic agent, everybody thinks he's right wing. And here he is talking about a book by Lenin. Woke. Anyway, this is a really good book by Lenin, which talks about strategy and tactics. He actually goes through all the things that the Bolsheviks had to go through, all their trials and tribulations and what they had to learn. Times where they had to compromise, really realistic, practical political advice from Lenin. And he is also hammering on basically these left-wing theory cells who existed not only in Russia and in the Soviet Union after the revolution, but also all across Europe. And it's a fascinating book. I mean, he goes into what the communists in Britain should do, whether they should ally with Labour or not. He talks about different tactics to fight against liberals like David Lloyd George or conservatives like Winston Churchill. At other points, he talks about different types of peasants or different types of working men and how they could be managed. He talks about how trade unions, labor unions, tend to be quite reactionary, and how you as the communist have to deal with that. All really, really interesting stuff. I recommend it. It's not that long. I think it was like a kind of pamphlet. It's in the Collected Works of Lenin. Volume 26, I think, written in 1920. And for me, this is where Lenin is at his best, giving practical advice on things that need to be done. Apologies, it's volume 31, not 26, volume 31 of the Collected Works of Lenin that you'll find this in. Another really good bit of it is when he's talking about how to deal with the what he calls them small producers, basically like artisans, I guess you'd call them. He's like, you know, we're not going to be able to just kill all these people. We actually live with them. And he talks about how their basic kind of everyday life and their ingrained habits and so on residually kind of bring about bourgeois attitudes or petty bourgeois attitudes, and how liberalism is always there, the threat of liberalism coming in and making people passive and kind of decadent and things like this, and how a communist or a communist regime may deal practically with this problem. And his solution is not always, oh, just kill them all, or they must go to the camp or whatever. He's genuinely thinking about, like, how the hell are we going to deal with this issue? Because they're just going to keep on wanting to revert to becoming little bourgeois. Okay, and their dreams then become bourgeois. So that's something I really like. I also love Lenin's absolute hatred of the liberal and the bourgeois, which comes through strongly in his work. He has equal hatred for the kind of, well, what he calls the left-wing communist utopian. He has just no time for these people whatsoever. And I really like that quality in this book. So, second absolute classic is Prison Notebooks by Antonio Gramsci. Now, he wrote this book while he was in prison. He was imprisoned by Mussolini and basically wrote this masterpiece of, I mean, political insight. The section I really like of it, and the section I recommend, because it's the full Prison Notebooks, is three volumes. It's pretty big. I have this white selections from Prison Notebooks, of which the key section is called The Modern Prince, where he updates Machiavelli. And he is, you know, again, he was a Marxist, he was a communist, he was arrested by Mussolini for subversion or whatever. But he's grappling with, like, well, how the hell, from this point here of me being in prison under a fascist government in Europe, which is just absolutely, you know, we've got Hitler in Germany, we've got the entrenched capitalist pigs in Britain, we've got, you know, Franco in Spain. It's looking like disastrous from the communist point of view in Europe. Okay, the Russians did it, but that's not what Marx talked about. Marx talked about the revolution coming in an industrialized place like Britain, not in peasant, rural, agricultural Russia. So why isn't the revolution happening? Asks Gramsci. What is it that prevents the proletariat, the workers, from rising up? And he actually develops that thought that Lenin has with the kind of the small producers becoming liberal and bourgeois again through their ingrained habits. Ultimately, he's getting towards culture, ideology, and what he calls hegemony in this book, the cultural hegemony of the ingrained thoughts and habits of the people. So he develops a plan to subvert that, to change those to being something that may bring about a more left-wing society and ultimately a communist society. Okay. Now, this is a really interesting book for me personally for a number of reasons. He grapples with elite theory, especially Mosca. I'm not sure if he talks about Pareto. He definitely talks about Mosca. And of course, he talks about Machiavelli. And he doesn't say, oh, well, we need to reject these as reactionaries, right? He doesn't do a James Lindsay. He says, look, there's these guys have actually got something here, and they've picked up on really key aspects of how society functions. And if you remember, in Mosca, you've got the ruling class, the governing elite, and you've got the non-governing elite, a kind of layer below of civil servants and managers and you know, intellectuals and people who are, you know, write newspapers and dealers in ideas and secondhand ideas. And Gramsci says, like, this second strata of people, not just the government, but that this non-governing elite is absolutely crucial to capturing a country, to capturing a society. So his whole playbook is like, well, how can we get these people on board? Okay, I mean, if you want to put it a different way, how can we get all those non-governing elite reading The Guardian as opposed to reading the Daily Telegraph or something? Okay. It's a very insightful book. He talks a lot about intellectuals. He breaks down different stratas of like different functions within society in quite autistic detail. And not only is it good on that kind of structural level where he's breaking down how a culture works and how you might subvert or change that culture in a way that you want to see it, he also has insights on dealing with the working class and peasantry and so on. Like one of the things that he mentions in there, which I've always remembered, is he says, like, look, the working man, the average Joe on the street, cannot understand the abstract system. He's not going to get angry about the abstract system. You can sit down with a Communist Manifesto and Marx and all of that and try to explain it to him. He's just not going to get it, okay? His anger comes out at the middle manager, at the foreman, you know, his direct boss. And he notes that the capitalist system, or the big capitalist, is often able to use that to his advantage, okay? The British Empire actually did this as a colonial strategy. I remember my grandfather telling me that when he was working for the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, all the middle managers were Indians, which the Iranians hated. The Persians hated working under the Indians, as you might imagine. But if there was ever a dispute, the worker on the floor would get really angry at the Indian middle manager, and then he'd go to the big British boss, you know, Mr. Smith or Mr. Jones or whatever his name was, in his big desk. He'd complain to him, and he'd be like, oh, well, old boy, you've got a good complaint there. I'll get old Abdul in here and I'll give him a good ticking off. And this created a high-low middle mechanism with the Iranian workforce and the British capitalist boss against the Indian middle management. You can see, so it's a Juvenalian high-low middle mechanism. And Gramsci actually talks about that strategy, how the worker actually ends up having greater loyalty to his boss because they have like a mutual enemy in that foreman, and that foreman. Just fascinating things, really. So, yeah, for me, a genius. Again, he was on Team Evil. You know, I am not a leftist, never have been, really. But he worked out a great deal. And really, it's his playbook that the left have used to get most of their successes, especially in the West, in America and in Britain and in France and so on. It's been his playbook. You know, they talk about the long march through the institutions. That was his plan, and they did it, and it worked. So it wouldn't have worked if he was wrong, right? If he was completely wrong about how a culture functions, they wouldn't have had any successes. So clearly he was right in many, many ways. Third, Eric Frum. Remember? James Lindsay called me woke, right? Because I mentioned this Frankfurt School thinker. Well, this is called Escape from Freedom. And so Eric Frum was a Jewish guy, as all many of the Frankfurt School were Jewish. I'm not sure if all of them were, but Eric Frum certainly was. And of course, they escaped from Nazi Germany. And he was basically trying to understand how a society like the Germans came to support a government like Hitler's government. You know, they had the liberalism of the Weimar Republic and they had the promises of democracy, but ultimately the German people chose National Socialism. Okay. And Frum is like, look, he's trying to take this issue seriously. It's not like a kind of you know, hit job saying, oh, like the German people are just terrible because, you know, they have this authoritarian personality type, blah, 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 blah. He was genuinely grappling, like, what is it that led them to reject the freedom that liberalism was offering them under the Weimar Republic? Why did they go, or why do people go for quote-unquote authoritarian regimes? And this is a pretty penetrating study, because he actually goes into, like, what is it that people want? What makes people happy? What are their basic needs? You know, everybody talks now about Maslow's hierarchy of needs or whatever. Well, Eric Fromm basically does his own version of this in this book. And he says, well, if you look at medieval societies, if you look at many agricultural peasant societies, okay, they don't have a lot of freedom in the liberal sense, the freedom from. But when people are given that, it makes them anxious. They feel an anxiety, and they don't really want it. They seek safety. They seek authority. They, in a way, want to be told what to do. And Fromm is not, I mean, this is not like a kind of shit-lib idiot leftist book, you know? He genuinely is coming to terms and trying to grapple with this. And, you know, he was a clever guy. These people were not stupid. This is why they had audiences and they profoundly influenced intellectuals. You know, you may hate the results of what came from their thinking, but it is true. And it is something that people like Lindsay, who have this kind of reflexive repulsion against anything that isn't liberalism, capital L, right, who just reflexively point and call woke anything that's not this desire to escape from politics that liberalism represents. Anything that says, oh, there should be a government, or people may want authority, or anything like that, they just can't come to terms with that. And Eric Fromm in this book is trying to, from a psychological point of view, saying, like, well, what is it that people, why do they gravitate towards that? And this is something I've talked about many times on this channel. Me, I am from a libertarian background. My natural default mode was liberalism. I grew up in liberalism. I was a liberal. And still, I would say, in many of my, you know, in my everyday life, or in many of my kind of little choices or whatever, I kind of want to be left alone. I still basically, you know, have quite a few liberal tendencies or traits. Okay, you can't just lose that overnight. But I've come to learn that most people in most times and in most places don't want it. They find it induces anxiety. It makes them unhappy. People want other things. They have other needs other than this quote unquote freedom. Okay. And this is, you just have to be an adult and say, like, there's more to life than just, you know, wanting to choose between six varieties of burger or any of the other so-called choices that liberalism gives you. People have other needs. They've got needs for community, for guidance, for all sorts of other things. And if you're an adult and not a kind of 12-year-old child, you can just take these things on board, not just point at them and call them woke. James. Another very influential book, Raymond Williams, fellow Welshman. I grew up in Wales, of course. My mother is Welsh, if you didn't know. And he was a Marxist, and he wrote this book called Culture and Society. Now, what this book is really most notable for is Williams's concept of emergent culture versus cultures that are a culture that is dying or receding, and then the dominant culture. So he says that at any one point, you have a dominant culture. That is the thing that is currently hegemonic in Gramsci sense. Okay. Then you have vestiges of the past, the remnant of some past order. Okay. And I mean, you could say that the church in some countries is just a vestige of the past. Yes, it is theoretically living, but in a way it has been superseded. Certainly that is the case with the Church of England here. Okay. The dominant ideology of now, the dominant culture of now, supersedes what the Church of England, what power or what culture the Church of England seeks to promote. The Church of England is a vestige of Britain past. So it's receding, it's kind of dying in a way. This is an interesting model. And William's got all sorts of interesting things to say in this book. But you can see, I mean, he wrote this book in the 1950s, in 1958, I think it was. But it's kind of far-sighted. He's like, well, look, these things that we're talking about, this is what is coming. This is emerging. This is what will be. The current conservative order of the 1950s, you know, the one that Monty Python incessantly made fun of in the 1960s, that culture, that's kind of, that's dominant now. But it's not going to be able to stop all of these things for these reasons. And, of course, being a leftist, he's like, well, this is a good thing, and here's how we can do more to make this happen, etc., etc. I'd recommend Culture and Society by Raymond Williams. Fifth, The Little Red Book by Mao Zedong. Now, I'm not just being facetious putting this on there. What is the worth of reading The Little Red Book? My old PhD supervisor once told me that he carried a copy of this wherever he went. Because he was a full-on Marxist, as many academics are in this country. Have you ever read it? I happen to read this book, and it's okay. You can leave all that stuff that communism is wrong about, right? He talks at one point about the absolute need to get a hold of food production, which I mentioned earlier on, right? Always a disaster. You know how that ended. But there are things that you can learn from it. For example, Mao had an absolute from very young, you know, because it's got quotations from all across his career. Some in the 60s, some in the 50s, most of them are from the 40s and the 50s, but some going right back to the 1920s. Okay, so all the way through his life, he has these quotes. He had an absolute sense of friend and enemy in the Schmittian sense. And I think a lot of the best moments in this are when he's talking about friend and enemy, how to deal with contradictions between, you know, how to deal with your comrades, how to deal with your friends, how to deal with your enemies, the orientation you should have towards them. And there's a lot of boldness in this book, like political boldness. He's saying, like, we need to make things happen. The reactionaries, he always calls his enemies the reactionary element, you know, they need to, like, and he's got a great way of framing himself as an inevitable winning force, and his enemies is basically just losers waiting to be smited, basically. It's good. It's got a good kind of as a positive political program for enacting change in the direction you want. There's stuff to learn in there. You know, you'd be better off reading it than not reading it, I would say. When it comes, especially if you're interested in politics, vanguardism and things like that. One of the things I like about Mao, much like Lenin, he has an absolute distaste, an absolute hatred, really, for the bourgeois and the liberal. And in fact, he has this little essay elsewhere. It's called Combat Liberalism. That's also worth reading if you've never read it. It's called Combat Liberalism, where he just talks about how, like, liberalism's almost like this kind of disease that's always waiting to creep up inside of you that you need to, like, kill at any point. Just the way he thinks about it, the way he thinks about politics. Like, this is obviously a really fiercely committed guy. And you can say what you want about Mao. He changed the world. Certainly changed his country forever. For better or for worse, this was like one of the great men of history. So it's definitely worth having a little read of that one. And what struck me, actually, looking through it to make this video, knowing all the things I do about elite theory and about how politics works and so on, the fierce commitment to the organized minority. For Mao, the inner party is everything. The inner party. He also talks in many ways about how to discipline the mind, how to self-correct and all this sort of stuff. I mean, some of it is a little bit disconcerting, I would say. You're getting to like 1984 levels of totalitarian parts, which, of course, worried the liberal in me, you could say. But I still think there are things that you can take away from it, okay? Sixth, The Society of Spectacle by Guy Debord, a book I've talked about before. this really gets into some of that stuff we talk about, hyper-reality, some of the stuff we've talked about with Curtis. You're in a constant state of bamboozlement, really, and spectacle, much like the front cover of this book suggests. It's only a short book. You could easily read it in an afternoon or something, but it has a lot of insights, and it still remains the case now. Okay, some of the mechanisms of delivering the spectacle have changed, but essentially, he's right. And this is one of the chief tools of control that the regime has, what we call the regime has. And again, for the defender of this order, like James Lindsay, it's like, I mean, does he have anything to say about this? Does he like the idea of everybody just being kind of in a semi-trance at all times and all places? Like, is this good in your view, James? Do you have anything serious to say about it other than just call this book woke? This book is talking about something real. This book is talking about why so many people are asleep. And the methods used to keep people in that state. But you, James, want to keep them in the Matrix? Why? What for? Why do you defend this? And let's take your silly little woke right thing seriously for a second. Why do you defend this? Why should you defend this? Why do you want this? Why is it good? Seventh, Louis Althusser, Lenin and Philosophy and Other Essays. Now, the chief essay in here is his famous one about ideology and the ideological state apparatus. Funny enough, I just mentioned The Matrix. When I first read this essay, it was like stepping through The Matrix. It was like Louis Althusser explained. He just deconstructs and explains how everybody just lives in a bubble that they can't see outside of. Profoundly insightful essay. And basically correct. The older I've got, the more correct he seemed about so many things that he talks about. Now, you can say superficial things like, yeah, but Louis Althusser killed his wife, or he was a Marxist, or all sorts of other basically irrelevant details. He was an apologist for Stalin. That's another one that you'll read. doesn't matter. Because in that essay, and in other essays as well, he thought seriously about how people stay kind of supporting a status quo that basically exploits them. Because again, like Gramsci, he was trying to get to the bottom of why the Marxist revolution didn't happen in the way that Marx outlined in the Communist Manifesto. He was trying to understand, why don't the people rise up? And it's not even just because of, you know, the society of the spectacle and bamboozlement and media and all the other bread and circuses and all the other bullshit. It goes so much deeper. It goes so much deeper. The individual works by themselves. You don't even need a boss telling you what to do, because you convince yourself that your life choices are what you want, when actually it's what the system wants you to do. And again, you need a better answer than just calling this woke, James. Just calling it woke won't do. I used to give a lecture on Louis Althusser, and I remember students coming up and saying, that lecture changed my life, blew my mind. Wouldn't have been able to do that if it wasn't pertaining to something real. What did I used to say in those lectures? I'd be like, every moment of your life has been some process of ideological conditioning, not only by your school and your teachers and the TV, but by your family, by your mother and father, by Disney movies and Frozen and all the rest of it, even down to the choice of your clothes. Anyway, let's move on. Number 8, Rules for Radicals by Saul Alinsky. Again, we have to remember what the left want ultimately is not good. The end destination point we don't agree with. I'm a realist, not a utopian for one. And I also am morally repelled by the notion of equality. As anybody on our side of the aisle is. We don't like, we see equality as unnatural and actually undesirable and morally bad. And inequality is a fact of life, necessary for anything to function. However, that does not mean that these people don't have insights into how things work. And this particular book, A Pragmatic Primer for Realistic Radicals, has lots of good advice for how to disrupt, how to bully conservatives, how to get your way, how to do activism. Now, apparently Barack Obama read this book, which meant a lot of conservatives in America became very interested in this about 10 years ago. And they tried to counter it, and they wrote cringeworthy kind of counters to it. But none of them were any good, were they? Because especially the section on tactics, where he goes through, I can't remember, but were there 10, 12 different tactics? They're brilliant. Because they work, because they're effective. You know, he talks about just ridicule your opponent. People are defenseless against that. One of the things he said. Hold people to their own standards is another one. Great insights into how to disrupt and make your enemies look like idiots. And how to get your own way. Foucault, Discipline and Punish. I could have picked any number of books by him, but I like this one because it's the most hardcore and it's the most about power, which is, I think, the thing he is best on. He talks about the Panopticon. He talks about, you know, there doesn't need to be a man in the gun tower. Talks about the process of branding. Many other things. Seminal work. And this is another one. I used to give a lecture on this one too, among other things. And, you know, if he was wrong, he's got another book called The Birth of the Clinic as well, where he talks about how psychiatric institutions are used. And, if you think about the way psychiatric institutions are used today by power, some of the insights are obvious. Some of this stuff is actually quite obvious. But other aspects are not. And I just don't think that you should just say, oh, well, yeah, but we can dismiss him because he was a pedo. Oh, he's a pedo. Because this is, it's a brain dead response. And it means that your enemies have these insights into how power functions and you don't. Maybe that's why they control the discourse. And that's also why they gatekeep and control knowledge. What did Foucault talk about? How discourse and knowledge and power always go hand in hand. Where there is discourse, there is also knowledge, there is also power. Who controls Wikipedia, the thing that most people use to look up quote-unquote knowledge? Leftists. Who controls the discourse in society? Leftists. Who has power in society? So, again, you can make fun, you can dismiss, you can put your head in the sand like an ostrich, you can call it woke, you can call me woke. But the fact is, these books touch on very important things. And knowing them is better than not knowing them, especially if you're trying to win a political battle, James. Last book I'm going to give you. I've gone on almost an hour. Sorry, I got a bit carried away today, friends. Last book is Postmodernism or the Cultural Logic of Late Capitalism by Frederick Jameson. Another absolutely classic book. He talks about the experience of going to Las Vegas and seeing the Eiffel Tower, which is not really the Eiffel Tower, but the simulacra of the Eiffel Tower. It's a copy. Copy of a copy. He talks about a Beatles song, but how the Beatles song is just a pale imitation of another song. And I always thought, like, Frederick Jameson is using Las Vegas and Beatles in this book. But by the time I was reading it, it was like, oh, now I'm watching Gareth Gates on X Factor. Or even worse, like, you watch X Factor now, it will be somebody doing Gareth Gates, doing Tom Jones, doing Elvis, who already was copying something else originally. So you're so far removed from the original object, right? Or if you think about movies, you know, it's just endless sequels and franchises, or a movie that you've seen 10 times before, constant grind of the copy of the copy of the copy of the copy. Brilliant book. Great insights. Now, again, Frederick Jameson was a Marxist. He talks about late capitalism. He talks about this being a feature, a problem of late capitalism. But that doesn't mean we have to dismiss everything he has to say, because clearly he's pointing to something real. Clearly there is something to this analysis, because we all feel it all the time. Oswald Spengler also talked about this. Other people have as well. It's a left-wing book that may change the way you think. All right. Sorry if I got a bit narky doing this, but I've really been irritated by these people. It's like, you know, I mean, they're calling us woke right. How about we just call them, like, the thick, like, idiots who nobody even should listen to? Because these people are not even doing politics. They're behaving like 12-year-olds is what they're doing. And the fact is that serious people who actually want to see a better world in some way, they want to see a society that functions for them, that makes them happy, should consider all of these things. Get beyond this nonsense of left and right and woke and not woke and all this garbage. Garbage that is designed to keep you in a little box, to keep you from actually thinking about anything. Thought terminating cliches, as somebody once put it. All right, that'll do for now. I'll be back again tomorrow to nail conservatives. If you liked this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.